This is HPC Wire Soundbite, your weekly source of commentary and insight on the HPC stories shaping the industry. With Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and Addison Snell, CEO of Intersect 360 Research. And now, here are your hosts, Michael Feldman and Addison Snell.
Petascale plays processor derby.
And glacial advancements in energy efficiency.
Hello, everyone, and good morning for HPC Wire Soundbite for April 13th, 2012, available every Friday on iTunes and Stitcher. I'm Michael Feldman, editor of HPC Wire, and I'm joined once again by Addison Snell of Intersect 360 Research. Hey, good morning, Addison.
Good morning, Michael. You feel lucky today? It's Friday the 13th.
I'm always lucky on Friday the 13th. I just ensconce myself in my pillow-padded office and just don't go anywhere.
Hide from the world. Bad luck's out there, it's not happening to you, right, pal?
It's not happening here, so we're good.
Well, what's going on in the news this week? You're looking at petascale systems and all the different processors, huh?
Yeah, and that was brought about, you know, just in the recent weeks, we've just seen a lot of sort of more exotic supercomputing deployments, especially IBM BlueJeans. I think I counted there was 5 BlueJeans systems that were either announced or deployed over the past, let's say, 7 or 8 weeks. And then we saw a couple of the Fujitsu Spark 64 systems announced. One of them we knew about at the University of Tokyo. That was a petascale system that was started up.
BlueJean and Spark are exotic now?
Well, I mean, they're more exotic than, you know, they're not commodity systems, let's put it that way.
Right.
You know, they sell a handful of these every year, and, you know, they seem to be, I mean, especially the BlueJean seems to be getting quite a bit of traction now at the beginning of the year. They just introduced that formally at the end of last year. But then I started looking at all the petascale systems, and, you know, if you look at the peak petascale systems, there's 20 of them now, which is more than I thought.
There are 20 peak petascale systems in the world now, huh?
Right. And, you know, a number were announced after the top 500 ranked everything last year, so a few more got added there. But over those 5, over those 20, I should say, there's 5 processor architectures that are going into that. So, you know, every fourth system has like a new type of processor. And, of course, you know, there's the x86, of course, and then there's the GPUs, right, of course, because we've seen those in even, you know, lower mid-range systems and low systems.
Power processors in the BlueJeans, the Sparks in the K computer.
Right, in the K computer, the Spark 64s. And then there's the even more exotic things, like we saw the Shenwei SW1600 in the Chinese system. That's their own custom CPU. There's just one of those, but that's in a petascale system, which was announced in their Sunway Blue Light system last year.
The Blue Light Special.
Well,
that to me is where you get to talking about the exotic ones that are in there. I think exotic is too extreme a moniker to put on BlueJean at this point, or Spark, which has been around for a long time. But, you know, BlueJean is certainly a specialized supercomputing architecture, and you're carrying the power ones forward. But this is hearkening back, Michael, to what we were talking about in the supercomputing time frame, where we were looking at all the different processor architectures that are in play, and that's certainly been carrying forward. And it's not just the ones that we're already talking about in the petascale systems today. I bet we'll see the follow-ons of the Godson processors in the Chinese supercomputers going forward. And I think we're likely to see an ARM system pop up in the years ahead with a petascale supercomputer.
Yeah, I think the ARM is certainly in the pipeline. I think that'll probably happen, you know, towards the middle of this decade. That they've got a lot of work to do there. But yeah, I think we're seeing that diversity actually expand from maybe even what it's been in the near past. I mean, one thing I forgot to mention, like, it was the IBM Power Cell, the Power X cell that went into the original petascale system, the Roadrunner. That is sort of falling by the wayside, but in its place, you know, you were talking about the new processors that are going to come online probably. So
right,
in general, I think we're seeing an expansion. I mean, we're, you know, China has actually three CPUs in the mix now that they're aiming towards HPC. And then we didn't even talk about Kepler, which is a GPU architecture, obviously, but in a sense, every new GPU architecture is sort of a different architecture in that sense. They rejigger it a lot more than they do for like CPUs. So, and then of course we're going to see Intel Mike coming out towards the end of this year in the Stampede system, which is a totally new. It's x86, but it's a sort of a totally new type of architecture for that. So we're really seeing a lot of diversity, especially at the top end. It's dragging sort of that diversity, but we're going to see these systems obviously filter into, you know, mid-range systems eventually as well.
Yeah, well, I think we're going to continue to see that. And the big driving factor behind that is as x86 marches further and further into multi-core, you have expanding sets of applications for which a true high-performance optimization of that application in a multi-core environment becomes a greater and greater challenge. So in order to maintain real application advancements and not just peak advancements, people look for different processor architecture technologies that will continue to deliver those kinds of advancements. In the short term, as we've said before, people have compensated just by adding more and more memory. We see memory per core staying relatively flat, and it continues to go up and up per socket, per node. That drives more and more memory expense into a system. It makes it harder to maintain a efficient level of performance. So what's the answer going to be? Are you going to go to an accelerated x86 like a Mike? Are you going to go to a GPU accelerator and a lower processor main core like an ARM plus GPU? Do you want to escape entirely and go to a Blue Gene or something that's custom built? Chris Willard on our team wrote an editorial in HPC Wire recently on revisiting supercomputing architectures a couple months ago that talked about this exact problem.
Right, and like you said, there's a number of things driving that. There's power efficiency, certainly. I mean, you know, you look at the success now of like the Blue Gene systems, Blue Gene Q, the most power efficient system right now. And the GPUs, of course, and even the K system, the K supercomputer, they're much more energy efficient than the average x86 commodity system. So that's driving it. And then the density you talked about, you know, you can just keep adding processors, but you want each of those processors to be very powerful, or as powerful as possible. Otherwise, you know, it becomes a communication problem if you have millions of processors. So you see exascale and the multi-petascale deployments sort of driving this need for these more power efficient, densely computational processors. Right. And I think we're going to continue to see that. The bottom line is Moore's Law is just not fast enough to keep up with the demand of what users want in HPC. So they're coming up with architectural fixes to keep up with that.
Well, and you've got a feature article on HPC Wire this week that was written by Gary Johnson on meeting the exascale applications and what are the applications that we can start looking for that are going to run it at exascale. And we're not going to talk about that article in detail on the podcast, but you know, this is, you look at the problem, you're talking about petascale systems. We don't have a lot of applications running efficiently at petascale today. There aren't that many that run really efficiently at terascale today.
That's right. Right. And the point in that in that article is that a lot of those applications were the same ones that are running at gigascale. I mean, we've just basically scaled those up, you know, given them more fidelity, running them faster, but we're sort of dragging those up slowly. I mean, the software obviously moves sort of behind the curve to catch up with the hardware, and that's sort of always been the case. And I think we're going to continue to see that up to exascale. But yeah, a good point. And these systems that, you know, we're talking about with these new processors, they will be ahead of the curve for software as well. I mean, I don't think there's any way we can really get around that, although there's obviously a lot of activity around getting, you know, these exascale software platforms and models in place in advance.
Well, let's talk about some of these power envelope problems, going to our next topic. I mean, Robert Gelber was giving a summary in HPC Wire, something you picked up in MIT Technology Review, talking about the pace of energy efficiency advancements relative to performance advancements.
Right, and that first article was actually good news. I mean, if you're in the mobile computing space, and this was the point of that first article in Technology Review, energy efficiency has increased, you know, 100-fold over the last 10 years, and that's enabled you to do a lot of very useful things on a mobile system now that you couldn't even think of doing, you know, even 10 or 15 years ago. So it sort of bootstrapped the mobile device industry, the fact that now you can do a lot of very cool applications on a battery-powered device. But it's not fast enough for HPC because, like I said, we're on a 1,000x per 10-year performance trajectory. So if you get 100x energy efficiency per 10 years, you've got to make that up in your power by another 10x. And that's, right. Again, that gets back to why we need these more interesting processor architectures to make up that difference.
And I'll say it's even exacerbated in HPC even more than just the performance improvements by this multi-core phenomenon we're seeing, where we're adding more and more memory into these systems. So it's not just the processor and the heat that's driving the power consumption. All that memory is eating more power. Yep. Storage is the fastest growing product sector. That's drawing a lot more power. So HPC is really going through the roof in terms of the power demands and the need to try to keep up with something like this. And the advancements that we see in energy efficiency just don't keep up. So it's a question of where are we going to get all this power?
Exactly. And we didn't even mention, you know, the communication between these processors. That's taking a lot of power. I mean, to go back to the petascale and towards the exascale machines, there's different, there's a lot of different interconnects we're going to see there. I mean, I think there were four or five in the petascale systems now, and there's going to be, at least that many coming up over the next several years. That's taken a lot of energy as well. You're right. It's not just the processor. So, yeah.
So I mean, where are we gonna find cheaper power, Michael?
Well, that was the next story. I mean, one of the things, and we've talked about this before. I think we've at least written about it before. Iceland is a very interesting country with regard to the energy efficient power. They have a lot of geothermal energy, a lot of hydropower, and
they said they claim the cheapest energy per capita, right?
Yeah, it might be the cheapest in the world, or at least in the European and Northern Hemisphere. It's like half the price, basically half the price of average U.S. power. It's like four and a half cents per kilowatt hour. And they're looking to sort of attract data centers and other ultra-scale data centers, especially into the country. They've used the electricity in the past to do aluminum smelting, but there's environmental concerns there. So they've got some excess capacity, and they've got the potential to produce a lot more electrical capacity. And data centers is actually a good fit for them because they've got a lot of optical connection to Europe and North America. If you can do HPC co-location there, that could really save some of these big centers a lot of money.
Furthermore, Iceland was one of the first European countries to have a major economic crisis a couple of years ago, and then it was made worse by their volcano that they had that kind of shut down the entire country. So the Icelandic government has a lot of incentive to try to attract businesses from outside Iceland, say, locate your data center here, locate your HPC center here.
Yeah, that would seem like a great strategy. Like I said, they've got this excess capacity and looks like they're going to have more. I'm not sure what's going on underneath the covers there, if they're actually going out and trying to talk to countries. It seems like it would be a really good fit for European HPC. It's fairly close if you need to go up there and you know, put some expertise on site.
Right.
It's not too bad. It's in the North Atlantic. And
one important point, though, is I don't think Iceland is part of the European Union or part of the Eurozone. So when we talk about some of these European Commission funding, you know, multi-tens of millions of euros going to supercomputing over the next couple of years, I don't think it's likely that they're going to put any of that research outside of the European Union. I think that would tick off the European Union members. So, you know, to see some of those large national centers going to Iceland, I don't think is in the cards, but they could attract commercial investment.
Yeah, and those would be more turnkey systems as well, where they wouldn't need a lot of care and feeding that some of these, you know, these more exotic custom systems that are typically at the petascale now would need. Although, you know, I got to say, even those systems, if you can save, you know, millions of dollars per year. I mean, you have a three petaflop system, which some of these Europeans are about to have. That's like $3 million a year to run that 24/7. If you can save $1.5 million a year, that's a heck of a lot of incentive to move it off site, you know, EC or not.
Sure.
That means you can buy a lot more system, or you can do a lot more of whatever with that extra $1 million a year. That's real money.
If you can get the data in and out, then it doesn't matter where it is, then the power savings could be well worth it. And you'd also have to look at the staffing costs.
Right.
You know, can you get it staffed adequately if it's in Iceland? Is it going to be a lights out data center or what? There's staffing challenges. Staffing tends to cost even more than facilities, but it's facilities that's grown the most. Facilities costs are going up every year over year for the last 5 years.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there's those issues. Definitely, whenever you do co-location, you have those issues. And maybe you're probably right that it's probably more applicable to more, you know, commodity-based systems for commercial HPC. And you could see like an Amazon or one of the other large cloud providers moving in there and offering sort of that infrastructure at a much reduced price, especially to the European continent, just because it's fairly close there on optical cables. So it'll be interesting to see if Iceland actually takes some of this and pursues it. It seems like it is a great opportunity there. And, you know, I mean, not only do you get the good power, you get the free air conditioning. You can cool all of that equipment just with the outside air. And
it's
more
supposed data to be very nice in Iceland, Michael. They're all heated by underground geothermal vents. It's nice there. I've never been. Let's move to Iceland.
Yeah, very nice. Yeah, it's like 60 degrees in midsummer. But yeah, I mean, that's perfect for a hot supercomputer, a hot data center. I mean, that's ambient cooling you get for free, something you can't do in most of the U.S. So yeah, I mean, that can save you a little extra money as well. Yeah, it just seems like a great opportunity. I wonder if we'll see anything in the near future there.
We should go check it out, Michael.
We should. I think we should have a field trip and try and convince them. Okay, well, that's a lot of power news for this week, for sure. But you know, this is something that's going to come up a lot, obviously, in the stories ahead. It seems like it comes up every week, so it won't be the last time we talk about this topic.
Oh no, sir. We'll see this one again, and we'll see Petascale again too.
All right. Well, I think that'll wrap up our show. Addison, thanks a lot. Until next week, have a great one.
Thanks, Michael.
You've been listening to HPC Wire Soundbite with Michael Feldman and Addison Snell. Got a question or comment for Michael or Addison? Email soundbite@hpcwire.com. HPC Wire Soundbite is available every Friday afternoon from iTunes or at hpcwire.com. HPC Wire, the leading source for global news and information covering the ecosystem of high productivity computing.